Well, the last time we learned that Paul was being held in the palace of the governor Felix. And he was being held there while his accusers brought forth their case. He then, you know, has faced all of their, you know, accusations, their, you know, which were basically lies, and all the accusations that they brought forth were, none of them were true, none of them could be proven. But Paul faced them with love, he faced them with respect, and to me that was awesome. He stayed cool. He told Felix, who was the governor, he said, listen, none of these things are true. They can't prove any of these things, and they couldn't prove them. And so Paul just maintained his integrity. Now, remember what he was facing the opposition for was not just because he was a Christian, but because he was a Christian who was boldly proclaiming his faith publicly. And we learned that, you know, when we become a Christian, you know, you're going to face some opposition. But the moment that we step out and we start being bold and we start living our faith out in our workplace and in our families, that's when the opposition comes. But don't let that be something that scares you. That shouldn't scare us. Like, oh, so then I shouldn't share my faith. No, because then that's when we get to experience the grace of God moving through us in a really awesome way that you never would had you not faced some of that opposition. And that's what's happening with Paul. As he's facing this opposition, as he's sitting in prison, he is drawing closer to the Lord than he's ever been before. And so for Paul, it was worth it. And for us, it's worth it as well. So Felix decides to postpone Paul's hearing. He decides, you know, well, you know what, okay, I've heard some of the accusations, and so we're going to just kind of postpone this thing for a little while. And he uses that time to begin to ask questions of Paul on a personal one-on-one level. And so Paul then uses those times to tell Felix about Jesus. And we learned last time that Felix had many responses and reactions to the message that Paul brought. I mean, listen, for 2 years he gets to hear about Jesus from the great apostle Paul. And he learned all about Jesus. We learned that he was emotionally stirred, that he even shook with fear. And because of the amazing love that God had for this man, Felix, he gives him 2 years. And what did we learn was his ultimate response is that he refused to surrender. Instead, he just procrastinated. And in fact, what we learned about Felix is that it appears by the text that he procrastinated himself right into the lake of fire. And so we learn that procrastination is something that we simply cannot afford. Whether making that decision initially for Jesus or for us as Christians, when God tells us to do something, we need to do it. So that's kind of where some of the lessons that we learned. 2 years now have gone by. Felix the governor has moved on. Uncle Festus has now taken over. You remember him. Festus has now moved into he's the new governor. And it's almost like Paul's had enough rest, he's had enough relaxation, and it's time to, you know, get things moving. And that's kind of where chapters 25 and 26 are kind of linked together. We're going to break them apart, really, but, you know, that's kind of what happens in this, because watch what happens. Now remember, the Jews 2 years earlier came in, brought their accusation against Paul, their hate and their bitterness towards him. 2 years, you would think things had gotten better. Watch what happens as we pick it up, chapter 25, verse 1. Now, when Festus had come to the province, after 3 days he went up from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Remember, Caesarea is over on the coast of the Mediterranean coast. And then the high priest and the chief men of the Jews informed him against Paul, and they petitioned him, asking a favor against him, that he would summon him, Paul, to Jerusalem, while they lay in ambush along the road to kill him. But Festus answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself was going there shortly. Therefore he said, "Let those who have authority among you go down with me and accuse this man, to see if there is any fault in him." And when he had remained among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, he commanded Paul to be brought. And when he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about and laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. While he answered for himself, and here's Paul's, obviously these are some of the things that were brought against him, "Neither against the law of the Jews or the temple, nor against Caesar have I offended anything at all. But Festus, wanting to do the Jews a favor, he answered Paul and he said, "Are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things?" So Paul said, "I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know. For if I am an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I do not object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which these men accuse me, no one can deliver me to them. I appeal to Caesar." Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, "You have appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go." So there's a few things that we can learn in this historical document, really, that we're reading right here, this historical account of what was going on. What amazes me about this is that it's been 2 years since Paul stood in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount proclaiming that Jesus was the Messiah. The Jews attacked him. They tried to kill him. They were so filled with hate, so filled with venom, so filled with bitterness that they literally tried to pull him apart. And so, isn't it interesting that here we are now reading an account of 2 years later, and they still haven't let it go? Bitterness is a brutal poison, man. It's interesting here, Festus, the new governor in town, he comes and he pays Paul a visit. And so he kind of wanted to, you know, being this new governor, he wanted to try to befriend the Jews. I mean, because much of the area that he was governing was Jewish. And the Jews, believe it or not, during this particular time, and really all the way up until 70 AD, they were a very hostile group that was always just on the verge of a riot, on the verge of a civil war. I mean, the Jews were, you know, a constant threat to peace in the region because they wanted to govern themselves. And they were being oppressed by the Romans, of which they were bucking against it. They were, you know, they were resisting that. And so they were beginning a resistance that was going to be squelched ultimately in 70 AD when the Romans finally got tired of this. And so the new high priest is Ishmael, is his name actually. And he and the Jewish leaders are still brewing with this bitterness and they want to spew it out against Paul. And as I was reading this, you know, this past week, I started to ponder on this. I don't know. Paul's in prison. And yet, I don't know what prison is more brutal. A prison where there's bars and a locked door and there's guards, or the prison of bitterness, where you can be free to move around, but yet you're still locked up. There's still a ball and chain dragging onto your ankle. There's still something that keeps you in its bondage. I think that bitterness and hatred and unforgiveness that locks up a heart, personally, as I have seen and met with people in both conditions, I have met people that are behind locked doors and behind bars that are freer than people that are on the outside that are in the prison of bitterness. I think all of us, you know, I'm looking around, I see the nodding of many heads. You know what I'm talking about. Many of us ourselves have been locked up in the prison of bitterness. And I know it's a brutal place, man. It will eat you alive. I've heard it said before that bitterness is like taking poison that you have against someone, that bitterness that you're holding against someone, putting poison into a glass and then drinking it yourself and wondering why it's not affecting the other person. Bitterness, usually the person that we're bitter towards, oftentimes they don't even know that they're, you know, that you're angry at them. They're living their life and you're looking at them and saying, "How can they be so happy? I can't believe it. After all they've done to me, how can they be so happy about all of this?" And they aren't even aware. So the bitterness, it actually is a worm that eats us alive, you know. And here we see that taking place with the Jews. Paul's enjoying some R&R. He's bagging rays on the Mediterranean coast. And the Jews are going, "Stinking Paul, we still want to kill him." Now what is interesting is these guys rekindle a plot from 2 years earlier. Remember the plot to kill Paul? And when Paul was being held there on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, there was a group of Jews that said, "We're not going to eat, we're not going to drink until we've killed Paul." That plot was found out. Paul escapes We don't know what happened to those guys. I don't know if they starved to death or whatever. But notice these guys are much smarter than those guys earlier. They didn't make the same oath not to eat and drink. Maybe the Jewish leaders watched these guys wither away and die. I don't know. But they said, hey, we won't do that. Okay, we've learned by their mistake. But they still want to see Paul dead. Now, that is the epitome of bitterness. When you look at someone, it's one thing to say, you know what, I don't like that person. And it's one thing to say, I wish they were dead. And then it's quite another thing to say, let's set it all up. Did you happen to see this past week? Scares me to death. Where the pastor's wife killed the pastor. Yes, I'm telling you. As soon as that came out, I hid all the guns and everything in the house. Really, it is a sad thing, but it's got pastors all over the country going, what in the world's going on around here, you know? But talk about the poison of bitterness when we see these kind of things take place, even in our own culture. Well, they ask Festus, the governor, hey, bring Paul back to Jerusalem. That way they can, you know, plot and they can lay in wait and try and kill him. Festus wisely says no. Obviously, he wanted to talk to Paul more, and he wanted to learn more about this case. Why is this guy, you know, hanging out in my palace, you know, all everything paid? He's getting free room and board. He's getting a free stay at the ranch here. What's the deal here with this guy? And so he wants to find out what's going on. And so he then says, I tell you what, rather than me bringing Paul to you, I want you to come back, and you can then bring your accusation against Paul in Caesarea. He wants to have it in a controlled environment. The Jews accept, they travel to Caesarea, and then again, they break out the same old lies, the same old allegations. Again, they can't prove anything, and they can't prove any of them. And you know, as Mari and I were over in Germany, and you know, gang, I mean, you looked at the faces, and they look just like us. You know, they have a different accent. Some of them speak German, and they don't speak English at all. Some of them speak both. Some of them speak, you know, a little bit of, you know, broken English. But in all reality, they're people just like you and just like me. And that's what's so amazing. But the thing of it is, the church is going through the same kind of problems that a church is going to go through anywhere else in the world. And they are going through different things. And there have been accusations against Christian and against Melanie, just as there are accusations against pastors and their wives here in this country. And the one thing that we can learn from Paul in this, that all of us as Christian people, whether we're in leadership or not, but as Christian people, the one lesson that we can learn that we shared with Christian and Melanie is, you know what, let people say what they want, but let there be no proof. In other words, if someone wants to say something negative about you or about me, they have to make it up. And there's going to be no proof found to bring those accusations against us. And really, that is what, to me, what is so cool about Paul is here he stands and he's saying, hey, you know what, they can't, anything that they're bringing against me, it is motivated by hate, it is motivated by bitterness, but they can't prove any of it. That means none of it is true. And so when people say that about us, don't go defending yourself, don't worry about those things, it will run its course and God will protect you just as he did Paul. And that is the thing that we shared with Christian and Melanie. That's one of the lessons that I'd say Mari and I have learned over the years of being a Christian. So Paul then, he clears himself before Festus. He shares basically three areas, obviously. Maybe, you know, we could break it up into four that, you know, they were probably attacking. He says, hey, I've done nothing wrong, not against the law, not against the Jews, not against the temple, and not against Caesar. And then he even says, and I am innocent, and you know it, Festus. So Festus even obviously saw this thing that was going on. He was probably watching the Jews, watching Paul, and he knew how the, you know, the religious leaders were, and he was going, these guys are up to something. They just don't like this guy. And so Paul, you know, obviously brings that out. So Festus, being the politician that he is, he tries to play politics with the Jews. He wants to be politically correct, kind of keep peace with everybody. And it's interesting, he tries to get Paul to agree to go back to Jerusalem, knowing, okay, if I appease the Jews, that'll quiet them down. What's this guy Paul to me? He's no big deal anyway to me. If they kill him, no big deal, you know? And so basically he says, I'm going to dump this thing. It was left for him from Felix. Felix never finished the job. It was dumped onto Festus. Now Festus is saying, I'm going to dump him back onto the Jews and let whatever happens, happens. And this is very interesting. This shows you what kind of guy Paul is. Very smart cookie. It's almost like Paul is saying, you know what? It's been 2 years. I've had enough rest. I've had enough relaxation. You know, I've got a good tan. I've learned how to surf now. It's time for me to move on. And so he appeals to, with his innocence. He once again pulls out his Roman driver's license. And he says, look, guys, I was born in Rome. As a Roman citizen, I have the right to appeal my case to Caesar in Rome. And that is a right that he had that no governor could deny. That when he publicly said, I want to go to Caesar, the governor has no other option but to say, to Caesar you shall go. So Paul uses his legal right. Now this is interesting because I've had some Christians say to me, well, you know, I think that we as Christians should never go and use the court system. We shouldn't use the law. Oh, yes, we should. We're exhorted not to, to take each other to court and look foolish in front of the court system. But there comes a time when maybe we're dealing with things in the world that you may need to use the court system. There may be lawsuits that are against you or, you know, things that you may have to go and get an attorney and have to take care of business. That's wisdom, you see. And so Paul does just that. And in verse 11, he says, hey, I'm an intelligent guy. I want my trial before Caesar in Rome. So Festus, it's interesting because he knows I'm dealing with a hot potato. And he knows, I got a guy that knows his stuff. And so what am I supposed to do with this little hot potato? He realizes, I have no choice but to send him with an escort to protect him because he knows that if he is appealed to Caesar and if on his way to see Caesar something happens to him, it comes back to him. And so he realized, I've got to send you know, guards. I got to send him guarded to Caesar. So interesting. Once again, the Jews who had a death plot against Paul lose. Once again, we see that God in his great wisdom and in his great love protects his kids. And he will do that with you and he will do that with me. It may not always be the way that we want it, but again, Paul's life is spared. They want him dead. And they lose that chance. But it's interesting, they get him out of Israel, which I guess they've considered a consolation prize. Now, in looking at and retelling this whole story and this whole incident right here, one of the things that we see is the bitterness in the religious Jewish, you know, group of guys that hated Paul. But what I want to draw your attention to is this. Did you notice any bitterness in Paul towards them? Not at all. And that blesses me. Convicts me, I will admit. That convicts me. Because remember, he's been held now for 2 years. He's been falsely accused, falsely arrested. He was beat up, almost killed. There's been a plot against his life. He's been moved from his home. And listen, he has done nothing wrong. Nothing wrong. Now, that tells us a couple of things. That tells us, number one, that we can be doing everything right and still get persecuted for that. We can say, but what did I do wrong? I mean, I've done everything right. Have you found that to be the case in your families? Interesting. We've seen that happen, you know, in our own families, that, you know, where we're willing to take a stand for what is right, and the rest of the family looks at us as like, we're the idiots. Well, what do you mean? You won't stay here just because, you know, we have two people that aren't married living, you know, in sin, staying in the same house. Well, you know what? We'll just rent a hotel down the street. Well, you have to make a big scene, and then you could hear the little and the whole family when Mari and I come walking in. It's like, here they come, the troublemakers. And we're sitting here going, what? Well, I mean, we're the ones that are doing what is right, and we're the ones that get the flack. Have you found that out yet? Interesting, isn't it? That's going to happen in our life. But I want to encourage you. Don't allow yourself to become bitter. Because if anyone in the world in this passage had the right to be bitter and had the right to demand and say, well, I have my rights to be angry here. It was Paul. As we just described, all of these things, if you wanted to be filled with resentment, Paul had it. And yet he, in prison, was freer than the ones that were walking around in the temple in Jerusalem. Paul refused to be put into the prison of bitterness. He refused to be, poisoned with resentment. And I sense in this that almost, you can almost sense the broken heart that Paul had. It's almost like he's saying, hey, I have shared with my Jewish brothers. I have shared with Felix. Now I've shared with Festus. All of them have rejected Jesus Christ. And you can almost sense this broken heart that Paul has. Instead of a heart filled with bitterness, it's a heart filled with brokenness for the people that were attacking him. And I think that is the key for you and I. That if we're going to be attacked for doing what is right, don't allow yourself to be pulled into the same trap of trying to attack back, but have a broken heart for those that are attacking you, and oftentimes wrongly. Don't allow your heart to be filled with bitterness, but to say, Lord, you still love these guys. You want what's best for them. And even though they don't understand, isn't that interesting that the final words that Jesus said when he was on the cross was, forgive them. Why? They don't know what they're doing. In other words, God, they don't understand. I came to bring your love to them, and they instead hate me. And he's saying, I don't want you to hold it against them. They don't understand what they're doing. And oftentimes that'll be the case for you and for me when we're being attacked. Well, interesting. Festus, he doesn't know what to do with Paul. Instead of listening about Jesus, he tries to use Paul as a pawn to please the Jews. And instead of, Paul becoming better, he rises above it. He became better. And he doesn't get into a shouting match. In other words, Paul basically says, hey, you know what? Let's just get this thing going. Now, remember, I want to draw your attention and write this next to verse 3 or so. Chapter 23, verse 11. I want to read this to you again. Or you can flip back a couple of passages and remember what we wrote or read. But the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, you must also bear witness at Rome. Paul's been sitting here for 2 years knowing, Lord, I thought you told me I was going to Rome. And all this while, God was working out a plan, giving Paul some time to write. In this 2 years, he's written some letters, don't misunderstand. He's written much of the New Testament. And now he's going to write, more when he gets up into Rome. And so God promised Paul he was going to Rome. And here's something that I think each of us need to see this also in this little piece of scripture. For 2 years, Paul held on to that unfulfilled promise. We are a society, we are a people, we want stuff, we want it now. And God sometimes gives us his promise. And what we see here is Paul doesn't even get bitter towards God. God, I thought you said I was going to Rome. What's up with this? How come you're still sitting here in Caesarea? Now the Jews come back. They're still hanging on to this crazy stuff. Well, I thought you were going to take me to Rome. He doesn't even get frustrated with God. Paul understood God has a timing. God is working his plan. And I can tell you that, God is going to work that timing. And it's a funny thing that as we look at this, as he doesn't get bitter towards God, I have found myself, and maybe you find yourself in this situation also, with much less, if you will, things that have come against us than being arrested, put in prison, beat up, misunderstood, falsely accused. I mean, Paul has a reason to be bitter. I don't know about you, but I've gotten bitter over a lot less than that. And I think that this is a very good exhortation to each one of us to say, what in the world do we have to be bitter over? Why in the world do we allow that kind of garbage to come into our life anyway? Well, also the thing that we see here is the timing of the Lord. One of the things that I've learned over the years is that God has his own timing. I don't know if you've learned that his timing is usually not yours. Have we learned that? I mean, if you haven't, you will, okay? That is something that you're going to learn. I can remember, and this stirred my thought process, I can remember that from the very first time that God placed it upon my heart and basically told me through a pastor that I had at that time that I was going to be a pastor. And it took 10 years later that God then brought that back out. And then it was 2 years after that before I was finally a senior pastor of this church right here. So 12 years in the process. And it's interesting because during that first year, I was real frustrated going, okay, let's get this thing going. All right, Lord, you want me to be a pastor? I'll go be a pastor. And yet, amazingly enough, even though I never went to Bible college, I went to college, let me tell you. I'm kind of one of those guys that goes to the school of hard knocks. And, you know, it was during that 12 years of God teaching and working on me that he changed me radically. And don't misunderstand, he's still working and still changing. But why I bring this up is I have learned that God is always up to something, even if we don't see it. Even if we think he's not up to something, even if we think it's, you know, dead in the water, God is doing things. And so if God has given you a vision, if he's given you a promise, and you think, it's been 3 days for crying out loud. You know what? I want to encourage you, hold on to it. Even if it takes 3 years, even if it takes 5 years, don't give up. Because once God makes a promise, he never, ever breaks his promise. Ever. And he will always fulfill his promises to you and to me. He loves us. Be patient. Let him do it. Don't become bitter at God's process. Because what I have learned is that God cares more about the process than he does the goal. He's going to get you to the goal. Don't worry about that. It's the process. It was that 12 years that God, you know, made me and developed me into a guy that was going to love his people and love him. And then when we got to the goal, the process was the important part, you see? And so for you and for me, don't give up. Enjoy the process. Just say, Lord, all right, you gave me a promise. So when you choose to fulfill that promise is your business. What you've told me to be aware of is the process by which we get there. And enjoy the process. Because he loves you. And he wants us to make us more like Jesus in the process. And that's exactly what's taken place with Paul. So it's time for Paul to keep moving. It's time for Paul to go to Rome. But story's not over yet. Look at verse 13. And after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea. Oh, the plot gets thick. To greet Festus. And when they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, there's a certain man left a prisoner by Felix. In other words, I had this problem left to me from that loser that didn't want to take care of it. About whom the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me. And when I was in Jerusalem asking for a judgment against him, to them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to destruction before the accused meets the accusers face to face and has had an opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge against him. So that's the law. Therefore, when they had come together without any delay, the next day I sat on the judgment seat, commanded the man to be brought in. When the accusers stood up, they brought, listen, two words, no accusation against him of such things as I supposed. In other words, I thought they had something against him. They ain't had nothing. But had some questions against him about their own religion and about, and look at this, we didn't get this in the text, a certain Jesus who died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. So that came up somewhere along the line, the resurrected Messiah. And because I was uncertain of such questions, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But when Paul appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus, I recommended him to be kept till I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. And so obviously, Festus said, tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him. So here Paul sits, and now notice this is all going on behind the scenes because Festus' problems aren't over. Paul says, I want to go to Caesar. To Caesar you're going to go then. But Festus has a real problem here. He's got a problem. The Jews are gone, but he still has a Roman prisoner. He's got a Roman prisoner that he hasn't been able to pin any single legal charges against him. He's got nothing. He's just got a guy sitting in a cell that they've invested, 2 years into. And now Paul is saying, I want to go to Caesar. So Festus is saying, I'm going to send you to Caesar. But then he goes, well, what am I going to tell Caesar Augustus then? What am I going to write down? What are the things? I haven't done my due diligence as the governor to find out what the accusation is. And so he's going to look like a fool if he sends him up there. So Festus is truly in a real quandary. What to do with Paul? Isn't this interesting? So, King Agrippa the second and his wife Bernice show up. Now, let me tell you who this guy is. You're going to get a kick out of this. See if you can figure it out. Listen carefully. He was the last of the Herods. Now, understand, Herod technically wasn't his name. It's kind of like the popes who get put into a position, but they choose a title or choose a name that they're going to call themselves, you see? So when you're put as a king, you get to choose. And so he says, I want to be a Herod. So he's the second of the Herods. Now, at this time, he'd lost much of his power. He basically was just kind of, kind of a figurehead, kind of like Queen Elizabeth. She's just a figurehead, even though she really doesn't have a whole lot of political influence. So he's placed in the northern part of Israel. Now, this Agrippa, pretty much a dirtbag, just like his dad. This is Agrippa the second. The first Agrippa, his dad was none other than the Herod of chapter 12, who had killed James to appease the Jews. So he was a murdering, dirtbag himself. Now, you remember Drusilla of a couple of weeks ago? Remember we talked about Drusilla or Godzilla? This guy is her brother. Okay, this is Drusilla's brother. Now, let me thicken this up, see if you can follow this. Bernice, his wife, is also Drusilla's sister. You get the picture? He's married to his sister. Is this sick or what, huh? Does this sound like, watching a soap opera on TV right now? And so he's as the world turns in the life of the young and the restus, Festus, young and the Festus, maybe we call it. He asks Agrippa for some, hey, I need some help here. I got some egg on my face. I got to send him up. I'm the governor of Judea, and I got to send this guy to Rome, and I don't even know what to write. I got nothing against him. So he just, he explains his dilemma to Agrippa, and Agrippa gets all puffed up. Oh, I would like to speak to this man myself. Let the king take care of it for you, son. So watch this as Agrippa meets with Paul. So, we pick it up, verse 23. So the next day, when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at Festus's command, Paul was brought in. Bring in the man. Festus said, King Agrippa and all the men who are present with us, you see this man, about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed, look at this, nothing deserving of death, and that he himself appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write about, or write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore I have brought him out before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after examination has taken place, that I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not to specify the charges against him. So you can imagine this scene as, all of a sudden, and understand, this is not a trial. This is not a court session. Paul has appealed his case before Caesar. He's going to Caesar. That's where the trial is going to take place. What we have here merely is entertainment for Agrippa. He gets all the big guns in town, bring all the leaders in, bring the military in. They do a big military march. And also it was a last-ditch effort by Festus to say, look, I even brought him before the king, and we still couldn't figure out what to do with this kid. And so the day arrives, and we see here that the Bible translates great pomp, if you will, circumstance, pageantry. You can imagine as the king comes in and he's got his sister wife on his arm. and probably everybody at the, you know, everybody there is probably looking at them going, that dude is sick. Okay, the guy is sick. But anyway, he comes walking in and he's got all of his, you know, the jewelry is on and you know, all of this pageantry. The flags are flying, the trumpets are blowing, and, you know, it must have looked like a Hollywood, you know, red carpet premiere. And what amazes me is all of this for the Apostle Paul. One little Jewish guy. One little Jew with a big impact. And notice again that here Festus again proclaims Paul's innocence. And what's radical is they were holding him knowing, I got nothing against this guy, but if I let him go, the Jews are going to kill him. So God's protecting him. God's wanting to get him to Rome. But I want to remind you of what God said to Ananias when Paul got saved. Write this down next to that little passage there. Acts chapter 9, verse 15. But the Lord said to him, go, Ananias, for he is a chosen vessel of mine to bear my name before Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. And so Paul now stands as a fulfillment of prophecy. God always keeps his promise. Paul now stands before King Agrippa. Here he stands, just like God said he was going to happen. God knew exactly what he was going to do with Paul, and I love this. Here we have, and you got to picture this with me, all of the great and the powerful and the wealthy and the beautiful people of all of the Romans that were in that area. And with all of their power and all of their fine clothing and the jewelry, and then out walks little Paul. Now, I think I've described you to him. Josephus describes Paul like this, that he was a little bald-headed guy, bow-legged, bulging eyes, hook nose. So Paul was not one, he was one of those guys you say, I'll listen to him, but I'm not going to watch. And so out comes Paul. And he's kind of probably squinting because his eyes were bad, we were told in the scriptures. And he's probably squinting as he's looking around. The historians also tell us that he had kind of a squeaky voice. So are you getting the picture? That he's, you know, here comes this little ugly old Jewish guy, and he walks out in front of all of this pomp and circumstance. All of the beautiful people are there, and they bring Paul in. No wonder Paul would later write, God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the things that are wise. Paul stood there going, this is great. This is awesome. I'm standing before the king, just like God told Ananias that I was going to do. Now, that should encourage all of us. That encourages me because God used a guy like Paul, who many of us would probably look at and say, dude's a dweeb, okay? You know, but God chooses those kind of people. He uses me, okay? Which you can look at and say, he does use dweebs. I can see that, Rob. You're right. I got it. And so that means he's going to use you as well. He will use us. In other words, it doesn't matter. The vessel is not the deal. It's him. He's the message. We're the clay pots. He's the fire within the clay pots. It's all about Jesus, you see. It's about you and me saying, I am willing, Lord. I am available. Even if we're not one of the beautiful people, even if we're not the rich and the famous, even if we're not part of the powerful, God doesn't need all that. Does he use those people? Yes, but it doesn't matter to him. So if you're one of the beautiful ones today, and only you would know, that if that is you, and you think that's only the reason that God can use me is because I'm one of the beautiful ones. No, he will use all of us, you see. And that's what gets me excited. That's the story of the Bible over and over and over and over. We just finished the book of Judges. Over and over and over, we got to see God using people. Men that were afraid, men that were wimpy, women that were prostitutes, men that unwilling to stand and to fight, men that came from dysfunctional homes. God says, you're just the one I want. Because then you see, when something happens, people, I'm telling you, people, when I meet people that I knew from my old days, and I tell them, they say, so what are you doing now, Rob? Are you ready for this? I'm a pastor of a church. there is a God in heaven. You see, God gets the credit. He gets the glory because they know it ain't him. I'm telling you right now. And when God uses you, that's the way he does things. He uses guys like Paul to stand and proclaim him in front of the rich and the famous and the powerful and the beautiful. And he wants to use you. All you have to do is say, Lord, I'm ready. I'm available. But Rob, I don't know the whole Bible. I don't have it memorized yet. Don't worry about it. You just keep studying your word. You just keep being faithful to be diligent in your word. God will use you anyway. But I'm afraid. That's all right. He'll use you anyway. He used Joel last Sunday. And let me tell you, he was scared to death before he came here. I'm telling on him. We went to lunch a few days before I left. And he says, Rob, I want you to read the whole thing. And I said, Joel, are you scared? He goes, I'm scared to death, bro. And yet he used him mightily. You see? Make yourself available and watch what God will do. That's the way he likes it. So, what happens with King Agrippa as he gets ready? He summons Paul. Paul's standing in the middle of this auditorium. And actually, we've seen this place that Paul stood. They've uncovered it. It's kind of like a, what do you call those places again? Amphitheater. Thank you. It's still jet lagging. He stands in this amphitheater, and everyone's standing there. And those of you that have been to Israel with us, you've seen this amphitheater. And Paul stands there. And Agrippa says, Paul, speak for yourself. We'll find out next week what Paul said. And so you have to come back and see exactly what happens next week, man. It's going to be cool, let me tell you. Or you can cheat and you can read ahead. And I encourage you to do that. Read ahead and you'll find out for yourself. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for this section, Lord, where we discover many things. May we resist the temptation to become filled with bitterness, Lord, when things don't go our way. When we are falsely accused. When we're doing what is right and we still suffer. May we trust you, Lord. May we trust in your timing. And when you've given us your promises, that you're going to be faithful. And also, Lord, that we don't have to be the brilliant, rich, famous, powerful to be used by you. You want to use us all because you're the one that deserves the credit. And so, God, may we just make ourselves available to you. So we commit this morning to you, Jesus. In your name we pray. Amen.